I'm amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show. I'm Steve W. I'm here with Steve D on what is a really nice sunny day in our different parts of the UK. It's Saturday, May the 20th. Sun's out. Steve's got guns out. How are you this week, Steve?
I don't know about guns, but yeah, I'm all right, Steve. Yeah, to be fair, it's been a pretty slow week at work. I think it's been one of those weeks where the weather's been okay up here. So, you know, you always sort of like long for the outside, don't you? In terms of stocks, Steve, what a week. I think I was up about 3.5%, maybe something like that, 3.2%. But then Friday, just had a little bit of a pullback to about 2.65%, it says on Google Finance, which I'm never sure whether to trust or not entirely. In fact, it's just changed to 2.87%. So it's one of them. But either way, Steve, I mean, if we did that every week, you'd be bloody happy.
Yeah, just push along at 2% a week. That's all you got to do. And then you will be retired in probably a month. Maybe. Probably not quite that. But it's been sort of similar here, actually. The portfolio here has largely tracked the weather, which has been sort of steadily looking up for most of the week. And then about middle of the day yesterday, it absolutely smashed it down with a massive storm here. Like really, really, really heavy rain. The kind that you get nice weather, everyone's outside, haven't really bothered taking coats or umbrellas or whatever, and then they're all just trapped in it, and there's nowhere really to go. And then it kind of all settles down again about as quickly as it started. And that's what happened with my portfolio, really. It went up quite a bit. It went up quite nicely, actually. And then we had the Friday sell-off that was actually a Friday sell-off this time. And we finished slightly higher than we started the week over here on my portfolio. So I suppose that's kind of encouraging. I got an enormous dividend from Apple, which I invested, which is nice to have, I suppose, but didn't make a massive difference. I guess that's part of the reason for the thing being higher. Interesting place, the stock market at the moment. It's a bit busy at work for me at the moment, but I'm trying to keep an eye on things a little bit. A couple of interesting things I saw is, look, the US market has done kind of well so far this year. It's up about 9.6%, which, if we just stop the year now and called that the return, 9.6 in the S&P 500 isn't bad for a year. Unfortunately, we do have to keep playing for the S&P 500, but it's gone off to a better year than I sort of thought it would to start off with, Steve. I was thinking rising rates, grinding recession, things to go well lower or sideways mainly, and I'm trying to work out where I sort of went wrong on this. But in general, it looks like a sort of predictable thing. I was doing some digging into this, but how are you feeling about the markets right now?
Yeah, I could have guessed you had your Apple dividend, seeing as though you're channeling your inner Steve Jobs. For those who are listening, Steve's wearing what looks like a turtleneck under his jumper in this weather. I'm actually pleasantly surprised. Well, Steve, I think I said at the beginning that I thought we'd have a sort of positive year, but I thought it would be relatively flat. So for us to be 9% up, getting towards the halfway point, I'm pretty chuffed to that, Steve. I think it's pretty good. I know that the market is both bipolar and forward-looking. So at the moment, I guess it's pricing in a fairly cheery outlook. I don't know, Steve, to be honest. I'm the same as you, really. I always take it as it comes. I try not to guess these things. The only reason we guess them is for this, you know, this first show of the year where we try and guess things. And I mean, like the only person who's winning at the moment is Paul with that bloody Disney dividend. So I don't think me and you have got anything near being right. Well, I suppose I'm halfway to a non-recession year, but we will see how that plays out, considering half of the regional banks have nearly collapsed in America. But earnings look pretty good to me, Steve. I mean, I've been looking through the list of things I've coming in, and pretty often it's an earnings beat. Some of this is caused by efficiencies. I think the companies have definitely been planning ahead to try and keep their earnings looking strong. Revenues have fallen on some of the companies, like Home Depots at the In the midweek, they had a bit of a stinker of a report, but again, they had a lot of growth pulled forward, and they're not like a tech company that's starting at a low base. They're starting at a high base, so when you have growth like that pulled forward, you have to be something like Amazon to even stay flat. So it's an interesting market, Steve. It's one of these ones that I think, you know, people who are starting now will probably learn a lot from.
Yeah, so when I try and make sense of this, I think about the one prediction that I'm sort of still in the game on. You're halfway home on your no recession thing. And I think, you know, more than just time running out, it's gone about as well as it could have for you. It doesn't actually look massively like the recession is imminent either in the US. But where I think about my prediction that I think I might still get home on, I had McDonald's and Costco to both outperform the S&P 500. McDonald's is winning on that at the moment. That's up 11-ish to the S&P's 9.5. Costco is, well, if you rounded it to the nearest 0.5%, they would be level. I've got the S&P at 9.62 and Costco at 9.54. So I'm counting that as losing, which means I am behind. I need improvement from Costco in the second part of the year, but still very much in the game on that one, I think. So that's pretty close. The reason I was sort of surprised at the market doing well is when you look at, or the reason the market's doing well and I'm surprised by it, I guess, is when you look at what's done well this year, it's the stuff that will pull the market higher by itself. So I said the S&P is up about 9.5%, just over. And when I look down the top end of the NASDAQ especially and the S&P 500 by extension, you got Meta that's up 51%, Amazon's up 31%, Google's up 21%, Nvidia's up 118%, Amazon's up 37%, Microsoft up 10%. These things are towing the average upwards, and because they take up so much of the NASDAQ or the S&P, their outperformance will pull the index higher as well. What that means is that these things are getting more and more and more concentrated in the index. It's a big index, so it stays kind of diversified. But there has been quite a lot of underperformance lower down, which is where I think what I was expecting for a slowish, recessionist kind of year. I think the reason that my portfolio is doing well, yours is doing well, and the indices are doing well is just that big tech is dragging them forward, because people think of big tech as kind of the new defensives, I guess. When you think a recession is coming, when you think a difficult economic patch is on the way, you go and hide in the things that you, or if you're a kind of active portfolio manager, you go and hide in the things that you think are going to be stable and solid and so on. And that means things like Meta looking to be more efficient. It means things like Apple, who are fairly steady earners. It means things like Microsoft, who just defy time and keep doing things well. And it means things like Nvidia, which are really blowing off the scale in terms of AI at the moment, I think, which is everyone's new favourite two letters. But Nvidia, the real winner out of the AI stuff. Steve, any temptation to get yourself in exposed to this?
I did at 140. I had a price alert fire off about 140. I think it went down just under that. And it was one of those price alerts that you think you may have set while not really working out the price of something, because it set off and I was trying to figure out what that meant. I was trying to figure out, if I set this a couple of years ago, what did 140 mean to me? Why did I pick 140? And I couldn't get to the bottom of why I'd set it, and I didn't think it looked like particularly good value at 140. So I didn't pull the trigger on it. Obviously, looking back, that was some kind of error that I should have perhaps foreseen, I guess. But with NVIDIA, I think it's gone absolutely bonkers. I think the world's forgotten that all of big tech is making their own AI chips. They're not using NVIDIA's chips. So I think it's grossly overpriced at the moment. It's the first time in a long time I've agreed with Joseph Galson on something, because he does his normal like herder free cash flow, herder shares are going up, dilution, free cash flow yield, compounders, and
This is not the Joseph Carlson show that you're listening to. This is still playing footsie.
Yeah, sorry. I know that was like literally like listening to his 3-hour videos he puts up, but I've completely just removed myself from his from anything, any content he puts out, because I'm so bored of reading and listening to the same thing, the same narrative over and over again. So I don't know, Steve. I think NVIDIA is just, it's just nothing to me at this kind of price. I don't. Anybody who's buying here is just hoping it continues to go up. It's a greater fool theory here. Maybe at 140, somebody could have convinced me that you know, there was some growth ahead for it, and you know, maybe that would have been a good time to pick some shares up. But right here, Steve, I can't buy it. I've been really lucky as well, though, that my my European stuff is doing a lot better than I thought it would, and I think that's because the EU itself is doing a lot better than we probably thought it would be. So for me, Straumann and Sonova and VAT Group and ASML have all ran up quite a lot now. I think I'm nearly up 60% on ASML, so that's gone up a really long way. For when you've got your third biggest position running up from, it was flat last year, it went back down to, I was back down to level, and I bought more, and I've now gone from level to 60% up. That's pretty good, really. That's pretty good.
I think that's more than pretty good. I agree with you on Nvidia being a great default thing, but one thing that I guess kind of catches my attention is that AI at the moment feels like the EVs of 2 years ago, basically, which is that what you think is anyone mentioning AI, or I don't know how you have a picture of some AI, but before, when you just had basically a picture of an EV, you could IPO and make loads of money, and people would buy the stuff and bid it up. And then a lot of those things have gone through the floor since. And in fact, I think some of the underlying businesses are not that good. Some of the underlying businesses are definitely not that good, like Nikola Motors and so on. But in general terms, there was a big kind of boom in EVs, and pretty much any EV idea was finding money. We haven't seen that in AI just at the moment. I think probably just because financial conditions are tighter, but it does mean that all the money that would run towards the latest thing, it seems to be heading in Nvidia's direction, or one of the big techs, which is driving things forward pretty well there. So it's a different kind of market, I guess, is the thing that I'm noting here from 2020. And that point sounds obvious, but I think the thing that illustrates that to me most is the fact that this drive for AI stuff, I'm not hearing about loads of tiny AI companies that are basically unprofitable and tend to be unprofitable for the next 8 years, but nonetheless are going to IPO now and be huge in whatever time it is. It feels like the money's going towards the bigs, who have more cash around and better balance sheets and stronger positions and so on and so forth.
I think that's true, isn't it? I think I read at the weekend that Instagram wants to make a competing product with Twitter. And there was a few sort of comments and takes on that, who said that building social media today is going to be like exponentially more expensive than something like Facebook spent when they were building theirs, just because of the base level features that you need to have just to, you know, get the thing off the ground. And I think the thing is kind of similar now with AI and competing with Google and things like that. I don't think there's going to be many companies who come along and really make a serious quick dent into Google, because the amount of money needed to do it, especially in this environment when credit's as tight as it is, you know, we're talking about companies that are going to raise probably a tenth of what they could have raised a couple of years ago, and that's just not going to be enough to get the staff in, build the product, get the servers to compete. So I think in a credit sort of tight environment like this, Amazon's, Facebook's, Google's, their moats are expanding just because it's become financially impossible to compete with them now, rather than them just having, you know, just having all of the people here. But back to your earlier point, Steve, I honestly think it's not a million miles away from when we get like an S&P 12 or something like that index that we need to track, because people think these top 12, I mean, look at United Health as well. It's having such a wonderful time. It's another wonderful business that we've probably not. I owned it. I'm not sure if you've owned it, Steve, but I remember singing its praises to you at about 280 or something like that, and I think it's over double that now. It's one of those companies that I should have held on to. I don't know why I got rid of it. I had this fear that America was going to eventually switch to some kind of socialized medicine like the NHS, and I thought that it was just a clear path for them. Medicare was just like the step on the ladder to start getting it, you know, more widely pushed out. Once people realise how good Medicare was, perhaps they would be like, right, let's do this. This is great. But it just hasn't happened, and I feel silly.
I have owned United Health. I sold it to buy Bristol Myers Squibb back in the day, mostly because I wasn't entirely sure I understood the dynamics of how UNH worked and got my head around the US healthcare system. And it was around the time as well that a combination of Bill Gates, Warren Buffett and Jamie Dimon were attempting to make headway into US healthcare and finding that completely impregnable. That goes down as a kind of failed enterprise on their part, I think. So I owned it then briefly, but that was before I started properly looking at things and started really worrying about things like circles of competence, because back then everything basically went up, so it didn't really matter whether you understood what you bought or not. You just looked at your screen, saw it was green, and saw that something else was slightly more green, and tried to find things that were undervalued. It was quite hard back then with rates at basically zero. I think I go the other way on the S&P 12. I think this we will eventually see either a big washout in markets or some rates starting to normalize a little bit, and the various companies that have smaller positions, weaker balance sheets, that kind of thing, starting to get their feet back under them. And I think there'll be a bit of a run in those, and the big techs will slow down a bit. But we'll see, I guess. AI feels a little bit more opaque to me than EVs is the other thought that I have. With EVs, people understood what the shortcomings to that were. Like, for instance, you need charging infrastructure, which is a very visible thing that people understand perfectly well. I'm not sure that many people have that good a grip on AI in quite the same way. I certainly don't. I mean, I'm not that good on EVs, but I can understand. It makes sense to me, stuff like battery storage and need for range and need for charging stations and who's going to build them and all those kind of basic questions. Stuff about AI seems another step beyond me in terms of competence levels.
Yeah, same. I think I'm not entirely certain of the sort of clear business sort of premise of AI. To me, it seems like it could be a business bit of business destruction rather than something else, which is all well and good, but people aren't going to spend as much money as they would get in McKinsey and as they are to ask ChatGPT a question. So I don't know. I did see that Samsung have dropped their after Google's I/O, where they just basically said AI 3,000 times over a four-hour yep. period, Samsung have dropped their wish to go and join Bing because I think Google said AI more times than Microsoft said it in their earnings call, and thus that's where Samsung will go.
Yeah, and that seems to me to be more the kind of interesting issue. I guess we should briefly mention, because we've been doing a good job of ignoring this on this show, but everyone else seems to be talking about it, and it does seem to be genuinely mattering to stock markets at the moment. I knew that previous point that everyone's talking about this, but I hadn't really computed that it was mattering. The more I see markets lifting, people keep explaining this in terms of the US debt ceiling and progress being made towards resolving issues around the US debt ceiling. I'd always thought this was basically an inevitability, and I thought, you'd used the expression last week, Steve, I think from David Gardner, dark clouds you can see through. I mean, this is probably the most transparent dark cloud I've ever come across in my short investing career. So for at least a year now, I've been hearing stuff along the lines of, well, look, the debt ceiling issue will come round. People will make a lot of noise about it. Then it will get resolved, because it always does. And realistically, the consequences of not resolving the debt ceiling issue are just too great for the US. And neither side will want to be either seen to be or even be partly responsible for that not happening. And this seems to be stalling, and it appears to be taking protracted amounts of time, and everyone seems to be thinking, gosh, lots of uncertainty over whether the US will raise its debt ceiling and pay off its bonds and so on. And I sort of think, I'm not paying that close attention, but is there? And then people say, the market pushes higher, and people say, oh, it's because there's been a breakthrough in talks around the debt ceiling. There's chances it could be resolved next week. I'm like, is that why? Are stocks down because of that? I mean, you want to talk about buyable dips and stuff. That to me does feel like an opportunity. If someone told me, yeah, look, stocks are selling for less because people are unsure about the US debt ceiling, I would say, okay, go buy.
If America doesn't resolve the debt ceiling problem, you ain't going to want stocks. You know what I mean? You ain't going to want them. You're going to want baseball bats with nails hammered into them. You know, like, it's just... it's ridiculous, and the thing is, they're playing political football with people's livelihoods, and that's the problem that I have with it. Look, this is nothing more, and this, bear in mind, the debt ceiling has been raised 78 times, and yep. and it's only in the last sort of like 20 times where it's become this political football where the team that are out of power decide that they're going to try and impose some will on the team that are in power. And the problem is that all this threatening about, oh, well, we're walking off now, we're walking away from the table, is massively irresponsible. It is literally political grandstanding and political football with people's livelihoods. The debt ceiling has to raise. There's no other alternative about it unless you want mass unemployment, riots, death, starvation. Do you know what I mean? Like, what is the, why would you even, when you break it down to being as basic as that, Why are you arguing over it? You should be sat at the table and not allowed to leave until you've made your agreement. To be honest with you, if it was up to me, I would just eradicate the debt ceiling, because Congress votes on most of the spending anyway. So why they would have to vote on the spending, which eventually gets passed, otherwise you wouldn't have to, you know, you wouldn't have to constantly raise the debt ceiling. Then they have to vote again on raising the debt ceiling, where the opposition party, who maybe had let some bits go through that they didn't potentially want in the spending, now get the chance to try and repeal it. It's absolute political stupidness. It's one of those things that I think should just be completely removed from anybody who votes against raising the debt ceiling in America needs to just be kicked out of office.
I think your penultimate sentence, your point about baseball bats and nails is very good, but I think your kind of penultimate sentence there kind of helps me figure out, or is where I got to when I was trying to think about, look, everything you said is basically true, so why is this a market-moving issue? Markets don't move on things that are obvious. Markets move on surprises or uncertainty or something like that. Good or bad, surprises and uncertainty. So why are they moving on this thing that everyone basically knows is what's going to happen? And I think the only uncertainty is exactly what... Okay, so the party in government, whoever it is, will ask for a raise in the debt ceiling, and the party opposing it will oppose it for a bit, and then they'll talk for a bit and stuff will get done. The only kind of uncertainty I can see there is over what the kind of compromise that's given away is in exchange for a raise in the debt ceiling. So people will let some things through they don't want to let through and not other things and the like. That makes me think that, okay, so maybe there is a possibility that we end up with some, or the US, not us, ends up giving away something it didn't ought to, or permitting something it didn't ought to, in order to get what is essentially an inevitable and necessary debt ceiling raise. So maybe there's scope for wondering, okay, look, the debt ceiling is going up, but at, in exchange for what, or at what cost, or so on and so forth. And that might be the only reason I can think of this as a market significant activity, but I can't see that it really bears on my investing life very much, Steve.
I think it's lazy reporting. I think it's one of those things where people always go and seek an answer for why the stocks have gone up and why. I mean, you'll know this from your writing. Mm. One of the best articles that does well is, this is why this has gone up, this is why this has gone down. And I think sometimes the answer is no reason. You know what I mean? Because there was a little bit more selling on the day than there was buying. And I think that's kind of what happened on Friday. The market went up a hell of a lot on Thursday, and the reason it pulled back was because there was people taking profits, and I think that's potentially, Steve, as we know, selling off on Friday so they can have a nice beer on Saturday. But yeah, I just think it's lazy journalism, isn't it? They're always looking to try and sort of tag on why something went up and why something went down, and sometimes it just went because it did.
Yep, lazy journalism, as I know well from my writing. This is why this stuff went up, this is why this stuff went down, is extremely popular. Generally does very, very well. I would point out, I have never written an article with the title, "This is why this went up, this is why this went down," which is why my metrics are so invariably poor. But anyway, let's get on to talking about stocks, because we've got about 40 minutes left and about 4 stocks to get through. So that gives us 10 minutes, and fortunately, neither of mine is very interesting, so I can use slightly less than that, and let Steve fill it out with more interesting things like African British stocks. Let's start with some UK stocks that are not really UK things, shall we, Steve? How about some Experian? Experian is a FTSE 100 listed stock that reported earnings earlier this week. Reports them in dollars because 67% of its business is over in the US. So FTSE 100 stock is not really a FTSE 100 thing. I have this idea in my head that it's like headquartered in Ireland or something for tax purposes, but leave that thought aside for the time being. They report two sets of numbers, like all the best companies do. They report some GAAP numbers, and then they call what they call benchmark numbers, which are effectively adjusted numbers. Their benchmark numbers are all up, so everything's going great. Their GAAP numbers are not up. Their revenue GAAP number is up around 5%, so $6.6 billion. Their EPS, again in GAAP terms, is down 34% to 84 cents. They are guiding for around 4-6% growth for 2024. We've just reached the end of what they call fiscal year 2023, because they're one of those companies, basically, who thinks they're a year ahead of everybody else. So they're looking for 4-6% revenue growth. They currently trade at a PE of around 34. The reason for the difference between the GAAP number and the benchmark is kind of twofold. So there's a goodwill impairment, which is a one-off charge of 179. I've written billion, that can't be right, it's got to be million. And 45 million for previous acquisition over performance, I think, which I assume means they had to pay something away because it did very well. So a kind of add-on bonus as if you were signing a footballer. They bought back $175 million worth of shares in over the last year. The issue with this company, and they've got a few things going on. You know probably about Experian credit scores and so on. So they have effectively a business-to-business arm and a business-to-consumer arm. They have essentially selling banks data for stuff like mortgages. And in the US, you need what's called a tri-merge report, which is a report that includes the Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion reports for your thing to be government-insured. So the US makes up 67% of their market and it's growing okay. Where they're doing really well is building out base in Latin America, specifically Brazil. Revenue growth there is up around 16%. They've got about half of Brazil under their coverage at the moment. They're an interesting one, right? Rising interest rates, slowing mortgage demand, all that kind of thing. You wouldn't expect them to be doing terribly well, and they're not blowing the doors off by any means. But they are moving forwards as a company. There's growth in revenue. Earnings per share are down because of a couple of goodwill impairments and one-off charges. But if you strip those out again, they are up. The market sees this, I think, reasonably positively. Steve, do you have any thoughts on any of this?
Yeah, just looking down the figures now, Steve, to be honest with you, I'd forgotten to look. And actually, they look broadly better than I would expect. You would think that. In a tightening credit cycle, something like Experian is likely to be flat or backwards. And here it looks to be growing, I mean, pretty well. It's another one that's been somewhat hurt by currency as it's moving money around, but not to any great degree. It's an expensive stock, Steve, to be growing at these kind of rates. But I think you've got to think longer term with this and thinking that perhaps these rates are, you know, artificially low because of the market we're in at the moment, and there is a likelihood that that will growth rate will improve from this point onwards. What has been their sort of CAGR growth rate? Do you know?
Good question. I'm not sure, but I think it's lower than you might think it is. I don't think they've bumped along at a particularly impressive CAGR for a while. They are, if you think there's sort of three companies here that are almost indistinguishable from another from a very high level. So there's them and there's Equifax and TransUnion, and they all have the same broad three things going for them. They're all credit bureaus. They all do things slightly differently, so they don't put each other out of business. Think of them more like an oligopoly than an all fighting over one thing. They're all part of the tri-merge report, so they're all required for US mortgages. They all have enormous great databases that are pretty difficult to try and disrupt here, I think. They all cover huge numbers of people and businesses. The real difference is Experian is trying to build out its own kind of infrastructure in Latin America, mainly Brazil, and they're looking there for growth. At the moment, Latin America is only 15% of their overall business, and that, I think, is where growth kind of has come from. I agree with you, this is a very expensive stock. I don't think this ever gets terribly, terribly cheap. I owned it until recently. That's not me saying buy it, by the way. That's me saying never buy it. But I did own it briefly around the time of the, I say briefly, for a few months or so, around the time of the mini budget stuff, when the UK stocks in general, FTSE 100 stocks more specifically, actually including Experian significantly, all dropped quite sharply, and I thought I saw that at a price worth having. The dividend on that's about 1.5%. I was getting around 2%, I think. And I've since sold it because the thing got back to a high-ish level. I didn't see a chance to build a bigger position in it, and I thought I would go put that somewhere else. But when I look at this, I sort of think one to buy in maybe a crash. It reminds me a lot of the Buffett investment in Moody's, but the thing to keep in mind with Buffett's investment in Moody's is that was made during the sort of 2008-2009 time when things were in real strife, and that was one of the worst kind of hit areas of everything. They have a service that I think is very, very difficult to replicate, but gosh, it's a high price for something like that that doesn't really grow all that much.
No, but you can see where the growth is coming from here, really, can't you? I mean, we're looking at consumer services. Revenue growth was up 11%, 168 million members up, 23 million over the year. Pretty decent growth in Latin America, good performances across North America, decent in UK and Ireland, an improvement in Asia Pacific. So you can see that they've got a network effect here, haven't they? They've got people still flooding to the platform, signing up, giving them data, and the network effect there is the more people they sign up, the more data they have, the more businesses will come and look at that data. So there is a clear, it might be a light moat, but there is a clear moat here to having all of this data and all of these people signed up, and obviously the network effect of that attracting businesses. So, and then businesses saying that they only look at Experian, so more free people sign up to Experian. There is a clear network effect on how this works. It's just that it isn't actually coming through in the top line. At the top line at the moment, and maybe the top line from the past as well, at least the recent past, but. It looks like it's doing okay to me, Steve. It's again, I think it is just, like you say, potentially just a little bit expensive. Even when you look at their EBITDA margins, they're good, but they're not excellent. You know what I mean? They're not excellent. You're not talking about, I'm buying a 35 PE here because this company has the potential to make massive amounts of profit like Rightmove has done. I don't see that in Experian results, but this is a fine business, just not something I would buy. I think probably something that you'd be really happy to have bought 15 years ago and still be sat on, but today it's a different prospect.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, this one. I mean, there are kind of risks with them that they occasionally have data breaches all over the place, which are bad for PR. One of the best things about Experian as a business, and one of the things that really drew me to it when I was looking for stocks to buy, it kind of featured on my list, and then we had the mini-budget stuff and prices all went down, was it has really, really good cash conversion ratios. They turn a lot of the income they generate into cash because they don't have much by way of expenses here. There's no manufacturing, there's no raw materials costs, labor costs are not super, super high. They're attempting to do all kinds of interesting things. They're trying to build out, I think, a kind of digital wallet offering in Brazil, which is, I can't work out whether I think that's wise or unwise. I have a feeling it might be a kind of crowded marketplace, and I'm not sure that people want their kind of money attached to their kind of credit score in that way, and it feels like there's quite a few people trying to do it. So I'm a bit unsure as to what I think about that. So yeah,
ClearScore are trying to do something pretty similar over here. They're trying to get you to use open banking to connect your bank account so they can see your ins and outs and give you like an affordability score, and I think that is too much for me. I mean, I don't really like the data they've got on me anyway, and I just appreciate that they're an unfortunate thing that we need to, you know, to get around in the UK. But I'm definitely not going to be showing them my spending.
No, they did have, I think, in my view, the best TV ads in the UK. So I would talk last week about how poor the Verbo ones are. But the ones with Moose the boxer and Fleroy the cat, they were great adverts. My wife loves those. They were great adverts. They were really good adverts in that we still talk about them around our house when it's because we like the voices on those animals. They're bad adverts in the following sense. My wife could not tell you what company they were advertising. She can remember it's ClearScore or something else, but she can't remember. But she remembers the characters very, very well.
I've never seen it. I'll have to check them out afterwards.
I will send them to you afterwards. And I think they're pretty good. She thinks they're great. If you like talking animal things, which she does, you will like these a lot. But that's the first of our UK companies. It's not a UK company. I could see my way to owning this again in the future, actually, but it's the kind of thing that you buy if you think, I want to buy a great business and I'm going to squint past the price because I'm going to hold it for ages. It's not the thing you buy if you think the ambition of investing involves, as Howard Marks put it, buying well. You will buy badly into this, but you will get something good for your money, I think. What have you been looking at, Steve?
I've been looking at Airtel Africa, which I think, I don't know if we've ever spoken about it on the show before, so even the brief passing, I don't know if we've ever covered its earnings or not, but we did speak about it on JKR's show, I did speak about it on the Investor Way,
yep.
And from that we've had a few people say, no, well, why haven't you covered it on the show? So here we go, we're covering it. So I'm actually late to this one because I forgot they were reporting. I thought it was this week. It turns out when I looked, because I didn't see the results this week, I was like, there's something going on here. It turns out it was actually last week. So anyway, here goes. Quickly, just what the business does. It's broadly split into two arms, a mobile services and telecoms provider and a mobile money slash digital wallet kind of company. So imagine a kind of hybrid PayPal and Verizon mix up, if you will, and without Verizon's debt, obviously. It operates solely in Africa, and it's one of the sort of biggest telecoms providers in the area. Its corporate makeup is a little bit strange. It's owned by a company in Mauritius, which is owned by the Indian giant telecoms Bharti Airtel. But whatever is left of this company is on the LSE. So it's a strange structure, but it has allowed Airtel some freedoms to be quite aggressive in buying up spectrum, which is obviously the lifeblood of the telecoms company, whilst taking on some debt from its parents at somewhat reasonable rates. Anyway, onto the financial stats. So revenue grew at 17.6% in constant currency. Unfortunately, these currencies are very volatile, so when we net them back out, it's actually only 11% year on year. Again, this is another company that goes back to dollars, which I think is fine, and you'll find it's probably okay as I go on as well. So, across the group, mobile service revenue grew by 16.2% in constant currency, driven by voice revenue of about 11.8%, data revenue growth of 23.8%, again in constant currency, mobile money revenue grew at 29.6% in constant currency, and all of this tots up, I've wrote rots up, to be a quite unbelievable $5.2 billion, Steve. So this is a big company, really, bigger than you think. The margins are good as well, Steve. So underlying EBITDA increased 17.3% in constant currency, 11.4% in the reported currency to 2.575 billion. Underlying EBITDA margin, Steve, of 49%. Pretty strong. Profit after tax was 750 million. That was actually a decrease of 5 million. But when you consider that they've had higher foreign exchange and they actually managed to lose 245 million in derivatives, I think that's pretty good. Add them back on, Steve, and you're on for $1 billion in profit, so 20% margin. CapEx actually increased 14% to 748 million. That was in line with their guidance. They have invested quite a lot in spectrum this year. They've bought from Nigeria, DRC, Tanzania, Zambia, and Kenya this year. So it has been a bit of a heavy outlay kind of year. Debt's often been the sort of biggest issue that I've found with this, except for this that weird corporate structure, and that's actually come down. They've paid off another 450 million, so now they're only at 550 million of debt, which, you know, sounds like to me that's just one more payment, Steve, really, isn't it? Leverage is 1.4% despite 500 million of buying spectrum in the year, so looks pretty good. Dividend, Steve, because I know that's what Paul would want to hear if he was here. That's up 9% to 5.45 cents, which is about a 3.8% dividend, so not to be sniffed at. In terms of valuation, we're at 1x sales, 8x earnings. That's about what you'd pay for something like BT, but Airtel's earnings are growing 14 times faster. So analysts are expecting this one to grow at about 6.5% moving forward, Steve. Personally, I think that's it's a little bit low. I think they're missing a trick. I'd expect it to be a couple of percentage points higher than that, because mobile money is growing at a very fast clip, and I expect this to start really affecting the top and bottom line, especially now that MasterCard, Standard Chartered, etc. have all taken a minority stake in it. Competition is going to be strong, but Airtel has a bit of a guiding hand, and Airtel wants to spin off mobile money, and I think I smell opportunity with that, Steve. So just a quick few stats on mobile money. So the customer base grew 20.4% last year. That's 31.5 million users now. Transactional values now at 89.6 billion. That grew 41% year over year. Revenue for mobile money grew 29.6% to 692 million. EBITDA grew 26.4% to 344 million. So all of these, Steve, are moving pretty quickly. These are going to start contributing to that top line, you know, at a pretty decent rate. Mobile money is currently only adding about 13.2% to group revenue, but growing at the kind of rate that it is, it's only a matter of time, Steve, before it comes along and starts to add a little bit extra to that top line, which I do expect the telecom side of it to start to slow down. There's only so much growth that it can have there. But so ARPU growth on mobile money is at 6.8% year over year. Revenue growth, Steve, coming out at 29.6% year on year. It all looks really good to me. Basically, they have branch and kiosks as well for this mobile money. They're growing 11.5% and 10.8% respectively. Their multi-brand agents in their network has increased 44.1%. Like I said, 20.4% increase in the Airtel Money customer base, now 31.5 million users, 41.3% growth in transaction volume, Steve, 90.7 billion now being transacted through it, transaction value per customer up 16.4%. And the annualized transaction value, if you just took this last quarter and times it by four, which is a pointless exercise, but it's something they do, 102 billion, Steve. So there's still growth coming out of it. So pretty interesting to me. And just some key stats on the African market itself. It's 2.7% population growth, 40 million people entering the workforce just this year. There's quite a low penetration on the addressable market, so only about 47% SIM penetration across the footprint. It has low banking penetration, so something where Airtel can really sort of get their feet in. There's been quite a low adoption of key services, which suggests that should these things start to take on, there would be quite a bit more growth for them. The usage of voice and data is very low in a global context. So if Africa is to follow the well-worn path, then these things should definitely pick up. And they've now done 21 consecutive quarters of double-digit revenue and underlying EBITDA growth, Steve. So I think Airtel's a pretty interesting-looking company. I mean, I think we're past the point of being terrified that it's just a fraudulent enterprise. I think it looks pretty good to me.
I think you're probably right. I've lazily got myself into thinking it's thinking there's kind of risk around corporate governance here, and I think it's probably about time I try and stop thinking in that kind of way. It's an interesting kind of pairing of businesses, isn't it? You said like a Verizon and a PayPal, so I think of those as one very capital heavy, capital intensive business, which is Verizon. And that's the reason you said Verizon without the debt. The reason Verizon has so much debt is because it needs so much cash. It invests in what you might loosely call infrastructure in certain ways. PayPal, I think of as kind of exactly the opposite. I think of it as basically asset light, basically digital stuff. And you said you thought there might be opportunity with a spin coming up there.
They are spinning it.
You're interested in the payment provider, presumably, rather than the heavy infrastructure thing.
I think, you know, on the investor way, I said that I'd probably sell the telecoms business, but I do kind of like it. I think it's, look, I'm not buying something at a 30 PE because I want the money thing. I'm buying something at an 8 PE because I like them together. I think if you split them off, I don't see why, you know, why the telecoms provider couldn't continue to do, you know, to do good. The only issue I've got is that it wants, when it does spin out, it wants to do a bit of cable laying, which is, I'm really against cable laying as something that I'd like them to do, because that is a very expensive business. But if that is the infrastructure that Africa needs, then, you know, why can't Airtel benefit from it? I guess once they start to lay the cable, Steve, they're only growing that moat out. They could probably start building towers and selling towers if that's what they really want to do, although I would expect that that's probably not what they want to do. But, you know, is there money in buying this company here? I mean, we talk about Africa as if it's just a small place. You know what I mean? They're serving a whole continent here with telecoms, and at the moment at $5 billion. When this grows out, when Africa continues to develop, is $5 billion going to be a lot in 10 years' time? I don't think so.
Good. So that was going to be my question, which is, are they all across Africa or are they restricted to kind of part of Africa? Because for reasons completely unrelated to Airtel Africa, I was looking earlier this week at which countries have the highest birth rates. We'll come back to why that is in a second. But here's what I found from my list of the country top 20 countries with the highest birth rates from as of 2023. This is from Statista. Niger, Angola, Benin, Mali, Uganda, Chad, Congo, Somalia, South Sudan, Mozambique, Liberia, Guinea-Bissau, Guinea, Cameroon, Burundi, Afghanistan, Zambia, and Nigeria. And what you will notice about nearly all of those countries is they are all in Africa, or the vast majority, sorry, of those are in Africa. So one thing that means, I guess, is that you have a growing market here for your digital wallet business. There's going to be more people, at least, to serve these things. That doesn't necessarily automatically mean that there's going to be more money flowing through them. You know, higher net worth individuals are worth more than, in terms of this, worth higher than to lower net worth individuals. But a growing market here is presumably helpful. And it's a really interesting idea, I think, for thinking about the kind of things where if you're looking at infrastructure-esque type things, a nice growing market helps, Steve.
It really does, yeah, which is why I can't quite get over this analyst 6.5% revenue growth from this point onwards. We're talking about a pretty much halving of growth rate from this point forward, which I think, to me, that just doesn't seem right. You wouldn't invest essentially $750 million in Spectrum if you thought you was only going to get 6.5% growth out of it from this point forward. That doesn't seem to make any sense to me whatsoever. So I guess we'll see, Steve, is what I'm trying to say. I think this is a pretty interesting company with a quite clear path to growth ahead. It's just whether they can execute on that path. And look, they've had 21 quarters of double-digit revenue and underlying EBITDA growth, Steve. So they blatantly know about executing on this path. And for them, it should be a continuation of it, especially as we see our big UK brands, such as Vodafone, etc., start to fall away from these markets and fall away from everything in Vodafone's case.
Yeah, Vodafone is... Last I heard about Vodafone, it was looking increasingly like an acquisition target with people circling around that. But just on the debt thing, Steve, just checking I heard all these numbers right. Looking at revenues of around 5.2 billion, 49% EBITDA margin, debt down from about a billion to about 550. Is that right? I hear
That's
all
right,
that correctly?
Yep.
Unless there's something I don't know about that debt, and there might be something I don't know about that debt, but unless there's something really bad about that debt that I don't know about, that would not worry me in the slightest. I mean, the way we measure debt in terms of it being high is as a result of net debt against EBITDA. If EBITDA's around 2.5 billion and debt's around half a billion, that is nothing like high, from what I can tell, especially for something like this.
It's debt at the parent company, you see, so that's why I think they're inclined to pay it off. If it was debt at a bank, they would probably be letting this run to term, but because it's owned, actually, I think it's come from Bharti Airtel in India to the Mauritius branch has obviously given it to Airtel Africa, and now they're saying, like, right, okay, maybe we should probably start paying this back. And they're in a position where they can do so, you know, I would sooner have a company with no debt than some debt, so for Airtel, I'm happy for them to pay it off.
Yeah, especially if you keep growing that dividend at sort of 9% a go. I mean, I know there's more to life than dividends, and even Paul kind of knows that, which is why he hasn't made many videos lately. But just under 4%, growing at 9%, it doesn't take many years of compounding for that to become interesting.
No, I mean, it's interesting to me now, to be honest, if we've got a top line and bottom line growing like it is and can continue to do so, then a 9% dividend is just one of those nice-to-haves, cherry on the top kind of thing.
Last question, Steve. Still buying?
I have got quite a big position in this. It's meant to be a 1% position. It's already a 2. But it's a bit like Forterra, which we'll touch on later. It could become 3 or 4, and I probably wouldn't bat an eyelid of it. But it's one of those things that if people were copying my pie, I'd probably let them settle at 1. But I quite fancy a bit more of it, to be honest.
Excellent. Should we get to Forterra then? A UK company that is actually a UK company rather than one... For a UK company which at the very least is not denominated in dollars, like Experian or Airtel Africa.
Only because when it got kicked out of private equity, they kept its US assets.
Yeah. Okay, so Forterra earlier this week, the AGM is coming up, by the way. We'll come back to that in the week ahead of us, with it now being Sunday. But in the week just gone, Forterra announced their pre-AGM trading update. This is for the 4 months since the start of the year, basically to the end of April, so to end of April, start of May. Profits were 109 million versus 143 last year. You'd be expecting, I guess, with a company like this. This is one where I do own it, so I have expectations about what I'm thinking is going to happen, and I'm not expecting this to be amazing. You've only got to look at what's been happening at house building in the UK and house builders in the UK to think this can't be strong. But anyway, 109 million versus 143 million, down 24% from last year. Main reason they put this down to is inventory reduction in their customers, by which I mean house builders, effectively. They've already got a load of bricks. They can't build any houses with them. What do they want with any more? Forterra, by the way, makes bricks, for those who don't know. They are expecting, though, management's guiding optimistic here. They are guiding for this to improve during the second half of this year. And that struck me as interesting. I was expecting something much more pessimistic for at least the rest of 2023. But no, they're talking as though this will kind of come in line with the guidance they previously issued and start to tick up towards the end of this year. They've recently opened what is Europe's most efficient and high production brick factory in Desford, which is partly there to service kind of increased demand, partly there to help make things more efficient with lower power costs, because one of the big costs of making bricks is energy. They have, I think, secured around 80% of their energy needs for the year, so energy costs are at least visible at this point. But in order to kind of get that online, they are considering mothballing some of their less efficient operations, because with demand not there, they're working out how to navigate their way through this kind of spell. Imports of bricks are down 45% in the UK, they were saying, and increasing their own capacity by 22% means that all of a sudden what was a kind of fairly... the UK brick market's been one, Steve, as you pointed out, where demand comfortably outruns supply, and that's a big reason for owning these kind of companies, I think. But that's, for the moment, just closing up a little bit. There are a few interesting things I've got written down as kind of side notes on this, but did anything jump out of the report to you here?
Only really that how they're performing, exactly how we are at work. So we are about 20% down, which is, I mean, at the end of the day, we're putting floors and roofs on top of their bricks. So it's no surprising that if they're 20% down, then we're probably going to be too. But I was speaking to a couple of other people in the construction industry as well, and actually South and... South of England, definitely commercial work, they're actually doing pretty well, Steve, still, but commercial tends not to be a brick build, and the South seems to be immune to everything. Us Northerners who are struggling at the moment. But yeah, this is what we expected to see. The construction industry is slowing down, therefore Forterra by virtue slows down. If we're not importing bricks, Steve, that's a good thing, because that's a habit that we could hopefully break out of. Mothballing factories is always a sad thing to hear, because there's going to be people here who are probably going to lose the job, but it's the right thing for Forterra, unfortunately they've got to think about themselves in this kind of environment. Desford, to me, looks like an excellent piece of work. They have said that they will be remodelling other factories as well to get them up to standard, and making good progress on actually trying to generate their own power supply as well. They're taking a part ownership in a solar panel farm, aren't they? So trying to at least generate some free to cheap power, which you may as well do on a beautiful day like today. Might power Desford for a day or so. But yeah, to me, Steve, it looked fine. This is the report that I expected, and this is the report that I got.
Interesting. I thought I was expecting slightly worse, not in terms of the numbers coming out, but in terms of the kind of outlook, because everywhere else I look, the outlook for housing isn't great. I mean, I saw this week there was a headline that made my phone that said the OBR, or someone from the OBR, says the era of massive house price rises is nearing an end, which is bad news for house building, bad news for presumably the brick industry. The UK's birth rate is way lower. That's not news, but the UK's birth rate is way lower than the birth rate in Nigeria, say. But we're at 1.56 or 1.6, depending on where you look, which is below replacement for your population, so we're either looking for immigration or a rise in birth rates to keep things higher. And interest rates in the UK, Steve, look like they're a mess. They are obviously going up to try and tackle inflation. They are failing to tackle inflation because inflation is particularly stubborn in stuff like food, where rising interest rates doesn't do anything. And the Bank of England, as far as I can tell, has mainly been saying it isn't working, but we ain't got anything else, so we're going to keep pushing them up. And to me, I can't work out whether that is throwing good rate hikes after bad, so to speak, or whether it's the right thing to do. But I see this as a headwind for something like Forterra or the house builders in general.
So, I mean, imagine being working at the Bank of England and only having one job to keep inflation down and being paid £600,000 to do that job, and then not doing the job very well and then blaming other people. I mean, that would be an amazing job to have, wouldn't it?
But I think I'd find it quite stressful. I think I'd probably think, I don't know how to get inflation down. All I can do is move rates up and down, and they don't seem to affect inflation. So now what do I do?
See, I just assume that Andrew Bailey has a two-way lever on his desk, and that's what he does. He just pulls it or and hopes for the best. But in terms of Forterra, the reason why they've probably got a better guidance than a house builder is probably because of lead times. So if the house building industry is not expecting a very good 6 months, but potentially the 6 months after they're expecting to be good, they're going to start placing their orders, Steve, in the next 6 months to have the bricks there in time. So Forterra is probably thinking that housing market won't pick up in the next 6 months, but in the 6 months after it will. But for Forterra, because they've got a bit of a longer lead time, they'll start getting their orders in the next 6 months for delivery in the 6 months after. That's what I would guess, Steve. I have heard hints and rumours that Sunak wants to bring back the Help to Buy ISA because he thinks that that will somehow help to stimulate the economy again. I think the LISA has been terribly missold as probably a pretty superior product to the Help to Buy ISA, so why they haven't just tried to sort of even rename the LISA to the LISA Help to Buy ISA or whatever they want to call it. But that would stimulate the economy. But I am a bit sick of stimulating the house building industry. I think we should just tell them to get on with the job of building.
I'm interested in that idea. The return of the Help to Buy ISA after the chaos that the ticking time bomb returns, right? That was going to basically blow a hole in Paul's and everybody else's finance until it didn't. This is what will drive down stock prices, right? Everyone panic selling all their shares because they think they have to make a Help to Buy ISA payment soon. But on the subject of Paul, the big news for Forterra shareholders, the company did reiterate its plan to distribute a 10.1p per share dividend, subject to approval at the AGM, which is coming, I think it's the 23rd, so assuming that all goes through okay, then candidate investors or people who want to add to their investment have a choice. You can either buy it for about £1.90 a share today and get a 10p dividend back sort of almost immediately, or you can buy it after the ex-dividend date, which is, I think, about a month from now, and probably buy it at about 10p a share less. Up to you guys how you want to go about that, I suppose.
Yeah, it's much of a muchness, really, isn't it?
It is incredibly much of a muchness. I'm just working out how much of my portfolio Forterra takes up. It's quite a bit, because I like it as a UK stock. It's one that, in general, I sort of think in my head, I'd quite like to own a company that sells stuff into a market where demand outstrips supply by quite a bit. And there are competitors in here, but it feels like there's enough there for all the competitors to make out pretty well.
Yeah, agree, definitely. If we stop importing bricks, there's plenty of room for everybody to grow here.
Yep. Okay, should we talk about clearly not a UK company then?
Yeah, let's race through take two, because it says 59 on here, but I had a coughing attack in the middle of it, so we're maybe on 58. But let's go as fast as we can through this, Steve. So it was earnings this week for Take Two. The market liked them quite a lot, to be honest. It sent them up 12% on the day. So quickly, just to let you know, Take Two is a game maker and publisher. Its brands include Rockstar, Private Division, 2K and Zynga. And games you will know from these are Grand Theft Auto, Red Dead Redemption, Borderlands, NBA 2K, Bioshock, The Outer Worlds, The Kerbal Space Program, Words with Friends, and Farmville, Steve. And probably the best game ever made, Bully. Let me know if you played that one in the comments section. I think it had a different name in the UK. I think it was called Kinem Edit or something like that. But there we go. Let me know if you played it. Let's look at the numbers that they released then. So revenue was up 52.6%, Steve, to $5.35 billion, easily beating expectations. Earnings came in at -$7 a share, which is quite alarming at first, before I realised this included a £465 million impairment charge from the Zynga acquisition and about £55 million in capitalisation from cancelling some software titles. So these aren't real cash flow outflows, if that makes sense. So feel free to disregard them or not if you choose. Net bookings grew at 55%, coming in at $5.28 billion. Net bookings in this context refers to the physical sale of the game plus the additional digital extras that Take-Two sells after someone has purchased their product. So for example, if they sell a game for $60 and the DLC for downloadable content for $20, that would mean a net booking of $80. So all of that growth looks great. It's mostly coming from the Zynga acquisition they made last year, so don't expect any of that to move forward. And they actually dampened expectations too for the following year, offering this guidance. So GAAP revenue, they said, is expected to come in at $5.37 to $5.47 billion. Wall Street wanted $6.16 billion. EBITDA non-GAAP was expected to come in at $427 million to $479 million. Wall Street wanted a little more there as well. They also said that they had completed an underwritten public offering, sale of $1 billion in aggregate principal among its senior notes. $500 million at 5% due in 2026, and $500 million at 4.95%, and it used $350 million of these proceeds to service some debt it already had, and the rest of it's going to be used for general corporate purposes. So I guess we're going to be in the same place here, Steve. What on earth made this go up 12%? So CEO Strauss Zelnick has promised that there is good to come. He thinks Take-Two will hit $8 billion in bookings by financial year 2025, which is the year after next. They do silly things too. They think they're going to generate about $1 billion in unrestricted free cash flow, Steve, and it's not hyperbole too. Take-Two have about 48 games due out in the next couple of years, and 44% of these are brand new IP. But even so, Steve, I think hitting $8 billion is a wide goal, unless you're expecting to release the next game in, say, your Grand Theft Auto series, which, let's just run the incredible numbers past you, Steve. In a week where Zelda has been celebrated for passing 10 million in sales, Grand Theft Auto 5 in its lifetime has sold 18 times that amount, 180 million games, and is the best-selling game of the last decade, spanning an incredible three console cycles, and that's in both unit and dollar sales amounts. So if that's coming, then buckle up, because this is almost a Take-Two binary event, Steve.
That's interesting. So, yeah, I was also struggling with exactly what was great about this. I'm still struggling a bit of exactly what's quite so great about this. So $1 billion in free cash flow in the year after next. I'm hoping they're going to keep growing that after that. So they currently have a market cap of around $23 billion, and they've been taking out, so that's a return of around 4 1/3 basically percent. And they're currently taking out debt and servicing it at 5. So it feels to me like there's something to keep an eye on there a little bit in terms of free cash flow generation. Take-Two is always interesting. Every time we have this conversation, I think, oh yeah, it's the games company with what's that brand, what's that game they've got again. It's GTA is the one that I've heard of. I have heard of Words of Friends and Farmville, although I sort of think of Farmville as a kind of museum piece. These days, the middle lot, I don't think I'd heard of any of them, and I don't think I know Bully either. Impressive kind of growthy stuff, interesting acquisition thing. It'll be interesting to see how that settles down a little bit, I guess. There's always noise around kind of financials, right? So revenue growth looks huge at first, but it's not, and it's short of expectations in this case. Earnings look non-existent, but they're not, and they are, I suppose, short of expectations. It's a bit hard to make reasonable expectation things when you have that kind of gap impairment stuff going on, but I don't know if this is my favourite of the video game companies to be looking at here, Steve.
No, and I can see why. I can see why people don't like this. The reason I own this stock is because of it's got untapped potential. Essentially, it's really, really good on console and PC at getting the best out of its games, but actually getting them into mobile games, which generate a lot of cash, is really, really bad at it, Steve. And it's got this really good IP that it could potentially get onto mobile, make mobile versions of, and make a lot of money. I think a GTA, a Grand Theft Auto, or Red Dead Redemption mobile game would do pretty well, Steve, for them. And that's the reason why they've bought Zynga. Zynga is here to smooth out these big AAA releases that Take-Two do, and sometimes take 5, 6, 7 years building a game, making it perfect, releasing it, getting this huge cash inflow, and then spend 5 years trying to monetize bits and pieces of it, and eventually dwindle away until the next release. And hopefully they're going to try and take out some of that cyclicality to their revenue and earnings. And I think that's what Zynga will do. And I think we're going to see a little bit more growth from going forward. The reason I think most people have been disappointed with this stock recently is that they did release their big IP, Red Dead Redemption 2, which previously, the old game had a really good online game to it as well, online game attached, which gives the game a bit more longevity. So once you finish the campaign, you can go online and play with your friends and explore the world a little bit more. And Red Dead Redemption and Rockstar, Take-Two get the opportunity to sell you some bits and pieces to help you along with your journey, generate some little revenue, and smooth out those peaks and troughs. They monetized it terribly. They've not given it an awful lot of support. They've kind of dropped it. which is disappointing, really, when you consider. I mean, the last Red Dead Redemption is a cowboy game, essentially, had zombies in it on the online bit just to make it exciting for you. This one, you can just pretty much ride around, fish, and sell your fish and do a few quests here and there, and it's just not as good, Steve, and that's really the disappointing part of it. They had this opportunity to make something good, something to help us move along, and they didn't do it. But then this Zynga acquisition has come along, and it's just piqued everyone's interest again. I think this, the old business with all the other games, 48 new games coming, Steve, one of which is going to be Grand Theft Auto, plus, you know, monetization of mobile. I think it looks pretty good to me. It only takes one of these new IP to do pretty well, Steve, alongside Grand Theft Auto, to blow past these figures.
Yeah, monetization of mobile on something like GTA seems like an opportunity, even to me. Of the names you mentioned, it's not my kind of game at all, but something like NBA 2K also feels like it ought to monetize pretty well on a mobile device. I think I still prefer your Nintendo stuff from last week in the games space here, for fairly obvious reasons. If you're not as close into these sorts of things as I am, stronger looking IP and a nice bunch of franchises where we just trot out the next thing and people go and buy it. I didn't have Zelda down as that kind of franchise, by the way. I had Pokemon down in my head as that kind of franchise, but you were sending me some interesting stuff about kind of Zelda's raging success in the week. That must be going very nicely for you.
Actually, no. I think my Nintendo position has gone from being about 1% down to about 2% up. It's an old beast. It's difficult to move. I think people don't trust it at the moment. I think that's the big problem they've got, is that Nintendo tends to release good things and bad things after each other, and I think people are still kind of waiting at the moment for them to say, hang on, you've done a lot of good recently. When are you going to do something bad? And I think that's probably something that we could take advantage of at the moment and accumulate others' pessimism, Steve, and then you know, if Nintendo continues to succeed, which it's been in a run of succeeding, and if it continues to do so, you know, I think accumulating here will be a good thing.
Yeah, interesting. So releasing good things followed by bad things. I mean, someone will say that's what we do on this show as well, but we don't do it on purpose. And to be honest, I'm not sure whether this is one of the good ones or the bad ones. But I guess we'll leave it there. We've comfortably kind of crossed the hour mark, even with Steve having a breakdown in the middle and me going to hang out some laundry. Thanks for watching our show, everybody. Leave us a comment down below. Leave us one that doesn't just say first this time as well, especially if you're not first. New rule. If you're not first, you can't just write first in our comment section. You have to say something else. But thank
it's
you all
be a bit
very...
for the first people.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Go back and change it if you were first. But thank you all very much for watching. We've been Steve and Steve, and we will see you next week.